So this morning we're starting a new series in the book of Galatians, and you might look at the bulletin and say, Galatians doesn't start at verse 13 in chapter 1. We'll do something a little different and take the second half of chapter 1 first, because it gives us a great intro to who Paul is. Chapter 1, verse 1 starts kind of with a bang, because Paul's writing to people he knows, and so he doesn't provide much of an on-ramp. In fact, he brings out the hammer very quickly with them. So I think it'll help us understand chapter 1, to understand Paul a little bit before we do that. So this morning we'll be looking at who Paul is, his past, how God reaches out and calls him, and the beginning of his ministry. And so Amanda Miller is going to come and read our text for us this morning. Great, thank you. So we'll be looking at three points here. We all have pasts. Real change is possible, and real change is authentic. So we all have pasts. If you look at verse 13, Paul had a past also. Paul had a big history, right? He says, you've heard of my former life in Judaism. Paul had a big enough past that they'd already heard all about it, right? And so what is it? And it's... Paul's past life is notorious enough that they've already heard about it. And it's his past life in Judaism. So just to have a context, in first century, there wasn't only one way to be a Jew. There was multiple ways to be a Jew. There was the Jews that said, no, let's leave the city and go to the desert. There's the Jews that said, let's kill Romans. There's the Jews that said, let's be upstanding political figures. And then there's the Jews that said, no, the law is the most important thing. If we keep the law, we'll be good Jews. Paul was that last kind, a Pharisee, that he thought if we keep the law, that's the one important thing to all of his life. And so, but Paul's notorious past comes out of, there's an internal part and an external part. Let's look at the internal first, which is in verse 14. It says, and I was advancing in Judaism beyond many of my own age among my people. Paul had this personal ambition to become a great person. He was the guy that said, I'm going to be the valedictorian at high school. I'm not going to let anybody get beyond me. And so he worked super hard to be a better Jew, a better Pharisee than anyone of his own age. So he was the kid that said, I'm getting all A's in school. Or he was the young adult that says, by the time I'm 35, I'm going to be a multimillionaire. Or he was the parent that said, my kids will be the very best behaved in the whole entire neighborhood. Right? He has this personal, part of his internal drive is this personal ambition, right? And then the other part of this, his internal thing is, so extremely zealous was I for the traditions of my fathers. So he's got this personal inner zeal, this personal inner ambition, but he's also got this zeal for the tradition of his fathers, for the whole Pharisee way of life, the whole internal workings of Phariseeism. And when it says so extremely zealous, the word is actually that he was a zealot, like that he was one of these kind of radical fundamentalist believers in Phariseeism, and so he was completely sold out for being a Pharisee. So you take those two pieces together. You take extreme personal ambition and complete commitment to Phariseeism and to the law, and you put those together, and you get his external history. At the end of verse 13, how I persecuted the church of God violently. And tried to destroy it. It actually persecute the church violently isn't strong enough. The language he says, as an extremist, I persecuted the church like beyond measure, beyond what anyone even would expect. I persecuted the church, and then it says when it says I tried to destroy it. That's the word that is used if you're like if an army was going to go and destroy a city or sack and pillage and destroy a rebellious city, that's the same word. So in a sense, Paul's saying, I radically persecuted the church, and I tried to wipe it out. I tried to leave it raised as a bunch of burned out rock and rubble somewhere. So that's his expression of it here. How can we actually have Paul's own words to fill that out. If you look at the first quote on the top of the bulletin, this is what Paul says himself of his past. I myself was convinced that I ought to do many things in opposing the name of Jesus of Nazareth. And I did so in Jerusalem, not only locking up many of the saints in prison after receiving authority from the chief priests, but when they were put to death, I cast my vote against them. I punished them often in all the synagogues, and I tried to make them blaspheme. And in raging fury against them, I persecuted them even to foreign cities. So that's Paul's past. Do you notice something a little bit odd in this past? On the one hand, he's very religious, right? He's like, I'm an extremist for this religious law code, right? I'm going to live my life completely by this Old Testament religious law. So he's a religious guy. He's like, if I just do all the right things and keep all the right pieces, I'm going to be good. But what's one of the key pieces in the Ten Commandments, the law? You shall not murder. And so Paul, on the one hand, is very religious. But on the other hand, he's also, we could say, irreligious. Right? He also kind of says, I'm going to work this out in my own way. I can be a law to myself, and I'm going to try to kill and pursue these people that are a threat to Phariseeism. You see, because so there's this all this group melt. There's a salad bowl of different types of Jews in the first century, and Christianity becomes following Jesus becomes one of those pieces in the salad bowl. Eventually, it leaves the salad bowl, but for its beginning, it starts off as a new element in the salad bowl. And so, Paul's seeing this Jesus and believing that he was a sham and a charlatan. Persecutes him and persecutes his people. So Paul, in a sense, his history is both religious and irreligious. Right, you see that? So what's our past like? Paul's talking about his past. What's our past like? Because Paul's doing a very interesting thing here, right? He's writing to Christians, and he's very upfront about his past, right? In Southern Christianity, there's a tendency to say, I've got to hide my past. I've got to pretend like everything is put together and that I never was really a bad person. But Paul completely does the opposite. Paul, somehow faith in Jesus allows Paul to say, you know, I was a horrible person. I casted my votes to kill these people that you guys knew. Right? I held the garments and encouraged people to cast the stones. So Paul's faith in Jesus enables him to be very open and accepting of his past. And I think it's one of the fairly radical aspects of what Christian faith lets us do. For those of you that watch Mad Men, you'll realize Don Draper's the complete opposite of this. And for those of you who don't, and I'm not encouraging you to necessarily, but Don is actually the illegitimate son of a prostitute, but he switches his identity in wartime, and he switches his identity to this respectable family, and so he's got this great pedigree that eventually lands him in the top Madison Avenue advertising company. But he has to guard his past so carefully because if any of it leaks out, he's afraid his whole life is going to be destroyed. And so in season four right now, the big tension is anytime someone asks about his past, he diverts, he runs. He tries to seal off his past so nobody can touch it because he's afraid it's going to yank the stool out from under him and everything he has is going to come crashing down. So Don's life is actually very, very fragile, right? Like one little slip-up can bring it completely down. Paul's life is not fragile. Paul can say, no, I have faith in Jesus. I'm walking with Jesus. And you know what? That trumps even all of my past, even me who's got the worst past of any Christian in the first century. So how do you deal with your past? Is it something that you try to seal off and pretend it never happened? Or it might even be something that you pretend never happened, because if we get this wrong, then we sort of can be thinking that, you know, I really come to Jesus because I'm a good person, and I've got to make sure I keep my bad stuff out of the limelight. And even with our present struggles, our present past, or the lingering aspects of the things we currently struggle with, do we, like Paul, say, yeah, here they are, and we're a community that's actually honest with each other, or do we tempted to say, no, you know, I'm doing great. I got the facade of my life all put together, and that's what the community sees. But I think just the way that Paul deals with his past encourages us to say the real gospel gives us an identity and a place with Jesus that's so strong that even our past can't undo it. But what happens then in Paul's life to bring him to faith? Because if you think about how he's describing himself as this ambitious zealot, ambitious zealots don't change their mind about things, right? Paul thought Jesus was a sham, that he was a charlatan, right? And that's why he's persecuting him. But he's going to come to believe that he's God's son. But radical, ambitious zealots there's no reason why he would have changed his mind about who Jesus is, except that God breaks in. So in verse 15 it says, "When he who had set me apart before I was born and called me by his grace was pleased to reveal his son to me, in order that I might preach him among the Gentiles, I did not consult with anyone, nor did I go up to Jerusalem." So God breaks into Paul's life and reveals his son to him. He's telling us what actually happened. What's the story? It's that Paul, remember, in this first quote, he even asked for letters to go persecute Christians in foreign cities. And so Paul goes to get letters from the chief priests. He goes to Damascus because he wants to find men and women who believed in Jesus and arrest them and bring them back to be punished or even put to death in Jerusalem. But while he's on his horse on the way to Damascus, this light appears before him and knocks him off his horse. And it's Jesus himself coming and saying to Paul, "Paul, why are you persecuting me?" And Paul says, "Who are you, Lord?" He says, "I'm Jesus who you're persecuting." In a sense, Paul has an event that comes and just grips him, that grabs him, that he can't shake. It's not an incident that he like goes on and says, "Well, whatever, that was no big deal." This is the event that changes his life completely. Chris turned me on to Alan Badiou's view of truth as an event that we are in fidelity to. Now, Badiou's not a Christian, and he probably doesn't even believe in absolute truth, and we believe in propositional truth, but we also believe in narrative truth. And so, look at the quote from Badiou. He describes it, what this looks like in a loving relationship. It's clear that under the effects of a loving encounter, if I want to be really faithful to it, I must completely rework my ordinary way of living my situation. I shall call truth the real process of a fidelity to an event, that which this fidelity produces in the situation. For Paul, this event of Jesus showing up to him on the Damascus Road is the single thing in his life that reprograms everything, that he changes his ordinary life so that he completely works his life now around this event. It's what he looks back to. He always talks about this. It's what It's what enables him to move forward. It changes the way completely that he sees himself, he sees God. And so it's this event, it's fidelity to this event that is what changes Paul. Let's look at the pieces of this. And Paul, so it's God appears to him, but grace is all throughout how God shows up to him. In verse 15, it says, before he was born, God was at work. So there's an aspect of prevailing grace, right? Before he was, when he was a little kid, he couldn't even do anything good or bad. Even before he was born, God was working in him. That's kind of prevailing grace, that God's grace, there's a purposeful ambient grace that works in our lives even before we take our first breath in life. There's a purposed grace in verse 15, that he was called by grace. So Paul, that's a complete shift for Paul, because he would have thought as a Pharisee that I need to earn God's favor. So grace is not a religious approach to life, because it's not earning it, but it's also not an irreligious approach, right? Paul can't say, oh, you know, everybody gets grace. No, that's not necessarily the case. Paul can't say, you know, God, I deserve grace now because I'm irreligious. I set the rules. I set the standards that everyone else has to obey. And God, I want you to give me grace now. No, that's not what happens. God's grace breaks in and calls him. And then there's a passionate aspect to grace, right? God was pleased to reveal his son to me. It wasn't like, Paul, it's your time. I'm going to reveal my son to you. No, it's God had a joy and a satisfaction, a contentment to bring Jesus into Paul's life in this event that would change it completely. God rejoices when to bring his son into our lives, just like in Luke says, the angels rejoice when one person repents and comes to Christ. And then in verse 16, it was a powerful grace because it completely changed Paul's view of Jesus. Right? Paul was, he was working like a madman in this direction because he was convinced Jesus was a sham. There wasn't anything good in him because he was doing all he could to destroy Jesus' influence, Jesus' followers. He wanted to wipe it off the mat so that there was no challenge to Phariseeism. But God's grace changes him to move him completely in the other direction, that he sees Jesus as God's son, that he sees him as the most important thing, the central person in his life now. So God's grace comes in prevailing ways, in purposed ways, in passionate ways, in powerful ways. So we can think about what are the events in your life that have changed everything for you? There may be several different events, but can you see the event of God bringing Jesus into your life as that thing that helps you see everything clearly, that helps enable you to walk with Jesus in fidelity? And so one way to put the Christian life is to say it's walking in fidelity to that event of God revealing his son to us. But there's one more part here to what Paul's doing that Paul really wants to make sure we get. In verse 16, halfway through, he says, I did not immediately consult with anyone. I didn't go up to Jerusalem to those who were apostles before me, but I went to Arabia. And then even later in verse 20, he says, in what I'm writing to you before God, I'm not lying. Why is he so animated about what happens to him afterwards? It has to do with the tension in the situation in Galatia, that with the churches there. Because there's a new group of people that have come in and while Paul's been gone, and they're saying, you know what, Paul is just one of those Jerusalem guys. He just got the Jesus thing from the apostles in Jerusalem. It's just lip service. It's the same old thing that Peter and John are saying in Jerusalem. And Paul's saying, no, I didn't become a Christian because it was a good vocational move or because it was a good social move, or I felt like I needed to change my, you know, I was killing people, I needed to change, so I believed in Jesus. No, I became a Christian because God focused it on me. God broke through and showed me his son, completely separate from the track of the apostles in Jerusalem. And so, so Paul coming to faith is, it's a parallel but a unique revealing of Jesus to him. It's not connected. There's no connection between them. It's the same faith, but it comes from completely different sources for Paul and for Peter. And so Paul has actually three alibis to say this. In verse 17, he says, after this happened, I didn't go to Jerusalem. I didn't go talk to Peter and Paul. I went to Arabia. What was he doing in Arabia? He was either practicing his gospel to the Gentiles, or he was spending time in reflection or study. And then alibi number two is 18 to 20. He says, okay, I did go to Jerusalem, but it was only for 15 days, and it was after 3 years of being apart from being in Arabia. And I saw Peter and James, and that was it. And then alibi three is, then I went away again to the villages of Syria and Cilicia. I was completely unknown to the churches in Judea, except that they heard that the one who used to persecute us now believes and preaches and proclaims that Jesus is the Son. So Paul wants to make sure we see that his faith is sincere, that it's authentic, right? That he didn't follow Jesus because all of his friends did, or his parents said, you really have to do this, or there was some advantage to him. But it was uniquely God broke into his life and called him, and he authentically, personally, received that and reoriented all of his life around that. So I think this passage shows us that grace prepares and calls and leads us to the event of encountering Jesus, which rescuing us from both religious and irreligious approaches to life, so that we might sincerely and faithfully follow and walk with Jesus.